Welcome to Cooler Than Homework, a Disney Channel original movie podcast. I'm Nicole Sweeney, and I was probably in my local paper at some point in high school for some reason that, like, when we first decided to do this as our intro, I was sure I had an answer, but it was so unimportant to me that I don't remember why.
Peak high school Nicole. Peak high school Nicole. I don't even care.
Meanwhile, I'm Matthew Gatos, and I could probably list out like 10 times I was in the newspaper and exactly the reasons why, because that's who I am. But one of the weirder ones is when I won an essay writing contest in sixth grade for the DARE program about how drugs were bad.
My name is Marines, and I don't think I was ever featured in the newspaper. I'm not from a small town, but I was my high school newspaper's like editor-in-chief, and my first real job was as the arts and entertainment editor for my college newspaper.
I'm Sari Riley, and I was in my grandparents' small town newspaper because me and my brother were just out watching people race hydroplanes on the river, and they thought we should take a picture of these kids doing this old person thing.
In this episode, we are talking about Quince, and there's local news involved. I don't know. Mari, make it make sense.
I feel like I have to start with just letting you guys know something that won't be apparent from my plot synopsis. And that is that throughout this entire thing, the main character, Jamie Grover, breaks the fourth wall and she talks to us through the whole movie. And not only does she talk to us, but they're like voiceovers. And also she like misleads us in certain things. So it's like a whole structural thing to the movie that plays a big part. But I'll tell you what happened in the movie, and it isn't a lot. So this should be short. So 14-year-old Jamie Grover is an only child who really resents being the center of her parents' universe. They've got big plans for her, and they involve good grades and winning science fairs in order to get into a science magnet high school. Things that Jamie goes along with, but doesn't have in her heart. She wishes that her parents would pay less attention to her, and her wish is more or less granted when her mother gets pregnant with quintuplets. Once the babies arrive, things get wild because babies are needy and expensive. First, the family tries hiring a full-time baby nurse, but even she's like, nah, man, after the babies just won't eat and poop on schedule. Next, they are approached by an agent named Albert who wants to use the Quince notoriety to score endorsements and commercials and things like that. Albert is very clear that it's all about the Quince, though, and no Jamie. Jamie uses her newfound freedom to join the school's art club. She's reluctant at first, but the art teacher, who is like her mentor therapist, really insists that she try art out, and turns out she loves it. So Jamie starts drawing the Quince, and through paying attention, she kind of notices how her parents are seeing the Quince as a unit and treating them as a unit instead of like individuals. And she's really worried that they're going to put all of their expectations on the babies like they've done to her. Jamie finds that having no attention from your parents is not always that great when they stand her up on parent-teacher conference night, but at least the art thing is going well. Her art is selected to be in a school competition. She excitedly tells her parents, who are also excited and supportive, but then one hot second later, Albert shows up with an invite to accept Parents of the Year award from the governor. It's the same night as the art show. And instead of reminding her parents and being like, hey, that's the night of my art show, Jamie just gets upset and rips up her art and says she's not going to the art show anymore. I'm not actually judging her. It's a really teen thing to do. It's fine. Adam, the oldest of the Quince, gets sick, and Jamie has to leave school and rush to the hospital. But Adam is okay. Jamie uses this time to confront her parents, though, and say it. And she says that she wants to be her own person with her own plans and her own dreams. Her parents say they only wanted what was best for her, and they have a touching moment. Albert rushes in, but he's more concerned with the money they won't be making than with Adam's health, so the Grovers fire Albert. On the night of the art show and dinner, Jamie has decided to babysit her brothers and sisters while her parents go and accept their award. Soon after they leave for the night, however, Jamie realizes that the Quints were also supposed to attend the dinner. She calls her art teacher, therapist mentor who is also now an Uber driver. And he's going to give them a ride, but his stereotypical art teacher VW bus breaks down, meaning that Jamie and her friends, who I haven't mentioned at all prior to this point because they absolutely do not matter, have to take public transport the rest of the way. They meet some bikers on the subway who help them carry the Quints all the way to the governor's mansion. The governor offers Jamie a ride back home since she doesn't want to stay for the dinner, but instead she uses the ride to race back to the school and attend the art show after all. And she wins first place. And then her parents show up with the governor and the Quints because they remembered about the art show, and they take a picture and it's in the newspaper. So we brought it back home, people.
Matt, where is the cast of Quints now?
All right. Well, I'm going to start with, I think, the weirdest person who's in this movie slash the only sad one amongst the cast. And that would be Mr. Don Knotts, who plays the governor of whatever state they are supposed to be in this movie. It's unclear because the thing is entirely shot in Canada with Canadian actors. And then there's a governor of the state that they don't really mention.
I have thoughts on that, but we'll get to that.
But yeah, so sadly, Don Knotts has passed since this movie, but you probably have seen him in, you know, The Andy Griffith Show or Three's Company or Pleasantville or That 70s Show or the Incredible Mr. Limpet or so many other things that Don Knotts did during his extremely long life.
We gotta ask.
Unfortunately, I have not seen him.
So, I don't know why, but Don Knotts feels like he was just like part of my childhood. He was just around.
Same.
In everything, especially like the idea of Barney Fife from Andy Griffith Show is just like a character was enough to, like, I feel like inject Don Knotts into pop culture.
Three's Company is my major like reference point for him, but in general, yes, I totally agree.
I'm looking at his whole filmography. I'm very sorry, Don Knotts. I did not recognize you or your voice or your face or anything.
Weird side tangent. I remember specifically performing some sort of country song at a talent show once at a county fair. That's a other story. But at that same county fair, performing like just before or after the talent show was a Don Knotts impersonator who, as far as I can remember, just went up on stage and like said quotes from Andy Griffith's show. And he was good, but like that's not really entertainment.
Amazing. No, that's I'm entertained, Matt. I wasn't even there, and I'm entertained.
Well, you're welcome. Getting into the rest of the cast, we have Daniel Roebuck, who plays the dad slash Jim. This man is also, much like Don Knotts, been in just so many things that you've probably seen him in something, even if you didn't recognize him from it. Since Quints, he's been in everything from The West Wing to Lost to NYPD Blue, The Man in High Castle, Weeds, Glee. Like he's that guy. He's there in everything. Outside of acting, the only thing that I could really find was that he links to his professional website on both like his Twitter and other things, but the website has not been updated since 2011 and it shows it. And so if you want a nice like internet time capsule, sort of like the Space Jam website, you can go to Daniel Roebuck's website and just see into the past. On the flip side of that, somebody who's not acting much at all anymore is Elizabeth Moorhead, who played the mom slash Nancy. You may recognize her. She's in one like big episode of Seinfeld where she plays a professional pianist and the girlfriend of George in that episode. She's done a little bit of acting since Quints, but not a lot. Probably most notably, she was in Terminator 3, but she didn't play a big role in Terminator 3, so you probably don't remember her from that. But it does seem like she's living a pretty sweet life now because she's a director and part owner of a resort in Fiji. So good job, Elizabeth.
Nice.
Yeah, like that's the way to retire. It's just like, you know what? Mm-hmm. I'm going to own a resort in Fiji from now on.
I don't think about anything in terms of retirement. I think about what that is like as a quarantine situation. And that also sounds amazing. I do wish that I were quarantined at a resort in Fiji right now.
Yeah. Man, that sounds nice. Next up, we have Shadia Simmons, who plays Zoe, one of the forgettable friends in the movie. We've discussed her previously because she played Piper in The Color of Friendship.
The best one.
Yes, clearly the best DCOM so far, at least. As I talked about in that episode, she is now a high school teacher and running an acting school outside of Toronto. And she hasn't done a lot of acting since Quince and The Color of Friendship. But we will be talking about her on this podcast at least one more time in the future. The other friend in this movie is Brad, who, frankly, is a character I'm worried about, and nobody else seemed to be. Mm-hmm. But he's played by Jake Epstein. And this guy, apparently, if you're into Degrassi?
Yeah.
I don't know which is appropriate to say,
Degrassi.
Or which is the most Canadian. Degrassi. Just so much Degrassi, because he played Craig Manning on there for a long time. And aside from that, he has kept acting in things like Designated Survivor and Suits, and he is also very active in theater. He was in the touring company of both Spring Awakening and American Idiot, and he made his Broadway debut in Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark as an alternate for Peter Parker / Spider-Man. He was not one of the injured Spider-Mans in that show, thankfully.
That's why I have the most chance of recognizing this man, and I still don't.
I recognized his name. Like, his name popped up on the thing, and I was like, fuck yeah, Craig.
Oh, wow. That's commitment to Degrassi.
Listen, the first few seasons of Degrassi, The Next Generation, were so charming, and I love them.
I only remember Degrassi from, like, late night MTV or MTV2 airings, and so I watched, like, maybe 5 episodes total over the course of probably 5 years, so I have very little attachment or memory of that show. So yeah, I did not recognize him from that. Next up, we have Vince Carrazza, who plays Albert, who the agent, manager, whatever he is for the Quints. He's still acting and mostly doing lots of voice acting work. The biggest thing I could find that I did not recognize him from, and I don't know that he's necessarily recognizable from because it's voice acting, but he's the voice of Tuxedo Mask in Sailor Moon.
Oh,
that's a neat tidbit.
And this is a man who we will also see again later on this podcast, or I guess talk about later on this podcast, because you can't see a podcast.
Well, we'll see him.
We'll see him and then tell you that we saw him before as well. Robin Duke is also in this movie. She is the one who plays Fiona / the weird Irish nanny who was Irish for some reason. I don't know why, because guess what? She's not Irish. Not that you could tell from her fantastic accent in this film, but she was a cast member of SCTV back in the 70s, as well as Saturday Night Live in the early years. And you might recognize her from Groundhog Day, Sari, where she plays Doris the waitress.
Oh my God. I was racking my brain. I was like, the nanny looks familiar, but I can't look her up.
Well, also, more recently, people might know her as Wendy from Schitt's Creek.
Wendy. Who is Wendy?
Wendy is the owner of the Blouse Barn on Schitt's Creek.
Oh! I did not recognize her from Groundhog Day, but yes.
So more recently, yes, she played Wendy in Schitt's Creek. And fun fact, along with the SCTV cast and being on Schitt's Creek and stuff, she also went to high school with Catherine O'Hara, her fellow SCTV / Schitt's Creek co-star. So, little interesting tidbit I found out about Robin Duke, who I had only recognized from Schitt's Creek, and then was like, oh, wow, she has a hell of a career behind her already. That is, yeah, I didn't know she was on Saturday Night Live. That's super cool. Also a Schitt's Creek alum, we have James Call, who plays Mr. Blackmer, the art teacher. He is in an episode of Schitt's Creek in season 6. He plays Clive, the man who runs a venue that some characters are trying to rent, in case anyone has not seen Schitt's Creek and wants to avoid spoilers. But yeah, the art teacher is also in there. So they got all the Canadian actors in both of these things. He has continued acting in other roles as well, and his Instagram is one of those lovely Instagrams we love to see from a DCOM star, where it's the most pure, just like living his life, posting dad jokes, and he has cute pictures of his dog and his husband on there, and it just looks like he's living a nice life. So good job, James.
I love that for him.
And the star of the show, we have Kimberly J. Brown, who plays Jamie. We've discussed her once before in our episode on Halloween Town, and we'll be discussing her at least a couple more times on this podcast, I think. she still looks exactly the same, which is sort of wild to like go look at her Instagram and it's like 20 years after Quince and you're like, yeah, that's definitely her. Like, still the same.
Her headshot on IMDb is like, I'm like, is this, you can tell that this is a photo of an adult woman and not a like tween, right. But that's it. That's like, that's literally, that's it. That's the only difference.
And she has a cameo if you would like to get a message from her, or she also has a YouTube channel where she's been posting some quarantine vlogs. Yeah, I thought, I literally had the idea today to like try and get her to do a cameo, like a shout out to Cooler Than Homework kind of thing. And I was like, this is way too short of notice. I can't expect that from her. But yeah, she also has a YouTube channel where she's been posting some quarantine vlogs lately, like cutting her boyfriend's hair, who we mentioned also previously in the other episode that she is dating her Halloween Town 2 co-star, Daniel Kuntz. And she also has an Etsy store if you'd like to get some arts and crafts from her. So if you're watching Quince and you're like, good art, I want to buy some of that, you can.
I love that for her.
Yeah. And then last but not least, the Quince were played by like 20 different babies because of laws and the times that babies are allowed to be on set. They said that basically the babies could only be in front of the camera for like 15 minutes at a time and then had to have like an hour break or something. So they would just like keep swapping in babies for scenes. And so I couldn't track down any of them because they're babies and there's too many of them. That's the tagline for this movie, I think. There's babies and there's too correct. Many of them.
Mm-hmm. I think that I mean, I definitely didn't notice in so many words, but there was one baby that had jet black hair and they showed that baby briefly and it was like, look at the baby with the jet black hair, and then never saw that baby again. So that was the only time that I clocked it.
Yeah, I don't think they did like, I don't think that they spent necessarily a lot of time finding 20 very similar looking babies to play the same like Adam. Like, I think they were just like, give us 20 babies that are the same age, please.
It's hard enough to find a small baby that people will let us use on camera, much less 20 small babies.
So, Quince, first things first, nostalgia check. Do you remember watching this movie before watching it for this podcast?
Not at all.
Vividly and repeatedly.
I for sure watched this movie a ton, but I have no recollection. And I also watched this movie last night and like can already feel it leaving my brain. So I don't know. That's the relationship I have with this movie.
And obviously not.
So did you like this movie? I guess I kind of spoiled it a little. I mean, it's possible that it could be leaving my brain and but like leaving in its wake a like really pleasant sensation, like I remember nothing that happened, but like a warm sort of fuzzy glow. But that's not the case. That's not how I felt about it. I did not enjoy this movie. To answer my own question first, how did everybody else feel about it?
I did not enjoy it either. You know, I don't know if it's because I'm out of practice of watching DCOMs. There's been a little break for us. I don't know if you've noticed, dear listener. Our recording schedule, you know, just kind of went out the window when the pandemic happened. So it's been a while since I like sat down to watch a DCOM. And I don't know if like I'm out of practice or if like after watching one every couple of weeks or whatnot, you build up a tolerance or something like that. Cause I went back to watching and it was like, oh no, that's one theory. The other is that the best DCOMs to me are the ones that flesh out a little bit beyond like the central character and plot in a way that makes you think, huh, that was surprisingly well thought of and it had some depth. This didn't have any of that, and it is just very simplistic. And while Kimberly J. Brown is like plenty, like she's fine, she's a fine actress and she had some charm to her, I just didn't really like anything about the story or the structure of the movie or the fourth wall breaks. Like, I didn't find it pleasant to watch.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was just very stressful for me the whole time. And I also wondered if it was because I was out of practice watching DCOMs and I was taking it too seriously, which is entirely possible. But also, it was just like a combination of things that were stressful for me. There were so many baby crying sounds throughout the whole movie. I felt like I was on an airplane with these babies crying. And my family is very small, so I've not been around many crying babies also. So I'm not used to them. The fourth wall breaking, did not enjoy that structure. Parents were very stressful to me. Both in the fact that they had this plan. I think because my parents were so hands-off, I was like secondhand stressed for her and being forced into doing something. And the adults, the way the adults acted, were just all over the place. The art teacher showing up with a car. Why would you do that? That's unsafe. Them just like running across town with babies. I took it too seriously, I think, which is why I really hated it. It was bad.
I liked it.
There's always got to be one, you know? Somebody's got to be the outlier.
It's interesting because a lot of the things you guys are saying, I totally agree with and did not like some of the same things you guys did not like about it. But at the same time, I think being out of practice in watching DCOMs, I was happy to be thrown into a simpler story and not the like I'm secretly a mermaid story. I think it was like nicer to be sort of warmed up for DCOMs again rather than just like thrown into like, oh, okay, this is complicated. Like, this was a pretty simple, like you said, Mari, like doesn't have a lot of depth to it, and I was kind of totally ready for that kind of thing. I think that's what my brain needed at that point. And I didn't enjoy the fourth wall breaks. I especially didn't like the whole thing of her lying to the audience repeatedly. And I think it was like after like the third or fourth time she did that, I was like, I get it. I understand. Yes. No, you're not pulling the wool over my eyes. I assumed you were lying this time. So that kind of like got stale pretty quickly. And I think, yeah, like it also had a deep Britney Spears cut from that first album. It had Soda Pop in this movie, which is always going to win my heart. I think it's actually over the one of the most annoying parts of the movie to me, which is the nursery remodeling montage, which just makes no sense time wise because they show like months passing and it'll be like in June, they painted the room. And then in July, they brought in a couple bassinets. And then in August, they brought in a couple more bassinets. And I'm like, wait, they did like one small thing a month and then just like took a break. That, no.
There are just so many things about this that didn't make sense and not, and like in this way that I don't feel like I was overthinking it necessarily. Like that to me wasn't the sense that I got. It was just that there was nothing there. Like the whole thing was just so much nothing. The thing about the fourth wall breaks is that those also like didn't really make sense. Like a lot of DCOMs will do like, I don't know, I'm talking to my diary, dear diary, yada, yada. Like I don't understand the thing. I got hung up almost immediately on like why she was talking to us. Like, who are we to her? Like, what's the, like, how are we situating this, like these fourth wall breaks, especially because they had this, like they had the energy of some of the like Dear Diary type things, but like the way that she was like all of the like stopping and rewinding and like that whole business, like, well, I didn't understand why that was happening. And it just felt like nothing was really that well thought out. Like everything felt really hastily sort of thrown together. And it was like, well, this is going to happen. And then this is going to happen. And then this is going to happen. Don't ask me what happened three beats ago. I already did that. I put that down. It's done. It's decided. We're just going to keep going until we get to the end. And I just it didn't really feel like there was a lot of care or thought put into it.
And I think that shows itself like most apparently in the last like sort of 15-20 minutes of the movie, where it just felt like they didn't really know how to wrap it up or like what the conflict of the major thing was going to be. And so it was just like, okay, we need to make these kids go across town for some reason with the babies, and a lot of bad things are going to happen.
Across what town?
fair question, because it seems like small town America, and then they're on the subway with bikers and all this stuff. And that, I think the bikers is maybe the thing I have the biggest issue with, because they're weirdly introduced as a threat when they get on the subway. They see bikers who are notoriously known for traveling by subway.
and that's how they get their names. Bikers.
And so, like, they're, like, creeping up on these kids with smaller kids, and they're looking mean. And the next thing we see is that they're helping them carry the Quints into the gala. And I'm like, they were carrying them just fine. Like, I don't understand why the bikers even needed to be a part of that. I think that's one of the more egregious examples of something that was just an idea that somebody threw out there and nobody said no.
This will be a fun, like, visual sort of gag, but didn't think about it beyond that. It was just, here's an idea, let's add it.
Yeah.
I may be thinking too much. It's probably possible. But what if the breaking the fourth wall thing was all carefully planned and intentional, and the script writers thought they were geniuses because it was the Quints who everyone was focused on telling their stories and always in front of the camera, and Jamie had to be a diaper and didn't want to be there. And so this was like her chance to be the center of a story, and we were her audience because no one else was paying attention to her, but she had us to narrate to.
Sure. Why not?
It does help in that way to make us relate with her before we're introduced to the babies, because you're asking a lot for people to be like against babies in a movie. like in their nature, most people are not gonna root against the babies in a movie. So like, you have to make us feel like we are her, or we can like be in her shoes. And I think maybe that's how they got around that problem. And it does, as much as I like, I think I like the feeling of the movie more than I like specific beats of it more, because the first 15 minutes are nothing but exposition of her saying that, like, my parents are going to have babies eventually, but first let me spend 10-15 minutes explaining to you what my life is like in details that sound completely unimportant, and you they won't really have a payoff, but I just want you to like me, please.
I feel like I felt the same way as Nicole about like the fourth wall breaks, but for the opposite reason. And it's kind of in line with what Sari is saying, and that I thought that they did think they were being really smart about it. And because the whole thing, like, you know, when the art therapist or whatever is saying, like, you're so observant the way you see things, it's like how nobody else sees them. And then I was like, is that why she's talking to us? Because she's like observant, and like she's the one framing the story, and she's got all of this insight or whatnot. So I feel like they thought they were being really smart about it. But at the end of the day, the story is so like thin that it felt like padding. Like, if they didn't have the fourth wall breaks and the voiceovers, this movie would have been like, what, 35-40 minutes tops? So it felt like they needed it just for that, like to add things in, because the plot was basically nothing.
I think I'm maybe lumping the fourth wall breaks in with like all of the other things that I didn't particularly like in the movie, because I like, sure, I hear you on that in terms of like maybe it had an intended purpose, but there are just so many other things in this movie that didn't feel like they had any purpose. Like, can we talk about Brad? Can we talk about how Brad's parents don't love him, and like the movie doesn't really care?
I'm so
like,
worried about Brad.
It's very clear that Brad's parents don't love him. And this is introduced solely so that late in the movie, Brad can be like, your parents love you, and I am like really upset because like I wish my parents loved me. But anyway, what are you gonna do to go patch up your relationship with your parents who love you? And I just like, I don't, what's going on there?
There's a line at the parent-teacher conference when her parents don't show up. Like, there's this wide shot of all these like tables set up in the gym where like she's sitting sad on a table and then gets up and moves to another table to be sadder. And in the background, we see Brad like just walking around by himself, and he walks over to Jamie to be like, Jamie, what's wrong? And she starts off by saying like, well, we knew your parents wouldn't come, but my parents didn't come. And I'm like, wait, we knew his parents were coming? Why is he there?
I kept expecting him to be like, you're so mean, because the way she delivers, like, we knew your parents wouldn't come. I was like, whoa there, don't need to rub it in his face.
What a bitch.
Yeah. Or his like dramatic monologue where he ended with, God, I would give every blue ribbon for one look like your mom gives you after school. I was like, ah, Brad. You need a hug.
But like, even that line again doesn't really end there. Like, he has that moment only to bring it back around to, but what really matters here is that you need to go make amends with your parents.
Yeah. Like,
what? No, what matters here is Brad and that he needs to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm. I think that in general, like, you know, the main characters in these movies are very, like, centered in the movie. And you sometimes do get, like, a little depth outside of that, like I was talking about, not at all in here. And I think the reason that it bothered me even more is, one, because they gave Brad such a sad backstory. It wasn't just, like, random or, like, you know, inconsequential. Like, they, every time, they just, like, brought up his basic, like, child neglect and abuse and then just let it, like, off and nobody said anything about it. But even in, like, the more superficial movies, there were other things that tied the friend groups together, or mm-hmm. even other dialogue that was, like, outside of, like, even it was like, see you at the swim meet, okay, have fun. Like, there was something else outside of the main character that tied them. Every time these three kids were together, it was like, hey, so Jamie, how's your shit going today? You know, how are you doing? How are you feeling? How are the Quints? Do your parents love you? How much do they love you today? And I'm like, why are they friends with her? Like, she never, I don't know, there's no, they don't have, like, a true friendship. There's no reciprocation of conversation or anything.
Yeah, the art club is, like, the only thing that we see them do sort of together, that, like, Zoe brings Jamie into this art club that she's a part of. But other than that, it seems like they have completely separate lives from each other. And even the one time they get Brad to come with them to be part of the art club at the museum, that's when he has his big moment where he storms off. And it's, so it's like, yeah, we don't really see a moment of them being, like, good friends other than mm-hmm. when they share their report cards with each other. And there's one moment that clearly is nothing. And no, like, she's talking to Brad on the phone, kind of, like, Jamie mm-hmm. is in her bedroom and she's on the phone for, like, 2 seconds in a scene, and it's just like, oh yeah, Brad, that's nice, okay, I gotta go, bye. I'm just like, that was probably the moment where Brad's like, hey, I need help, can you come over? And, like, she's like, yeah, whatever, bye, Brad.
He was literally like, I haven't seen my parents in 27 days, and she's like, that's nice, bye, Brad.
We all know Brad's parents, never around, no one ask follow-up questions.
Also, just Brad as an enigma of, like, I think he had a line somewhere in there that he went to the science magnet school, because when Jamie was saying her parents were pressuring her into going, he was like, oh, I'm so excited for you to join me at this, like, smart kid sciencey school. And so, but they were comparing report cards at their own school. Maybe it was, like, a day trip or something like that.
I think he's going there.
Going there. Yeah, I interpreted that, like, he was definitely going to get in, right? Because he's, like, a smart kid.
Yeah,
like,
he won the blue ribbon at the science fair, so he is already, yes, like, a lock that he is going there next year.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This makes sense. I thought it was, like, he was there during the day. I was like, why are you coming back to the school for someone who is clearly not your friend to visit her in art club? That makes much more sense. I thought he went to a different school entirely. I was like, why are you here, Brad?
I want to go back to the complete lack of, like, situating this place anywhere. I took one note, I wrote one thing down, and it was a nitpick that is way pettier and more ridiculous than anything Sari will ever give us from her science corner.
But I love this.
It is something that I always notice. The news cameras that were outside their house, there was a WIYZ and a KCUD. You can't have that. Those are the K is west of the Mississippi. W is east of the Mississippi. Your local news stations are not going to be a K and a W. It doesn't make any sense. But then I spent the next, like, hour thinking about, like, the cities that are along the Mississippi. Anyway, I concluded that this movie takes place in Minneapolis. So that's what I decided.
I mean, I feel like that's as good of a guess as anything. Like, it's not clear. The one time we see a license plate, it is clearly a Canadian license plate. Uh-huh. It's on the bus.
Yeah, it's the actual answer is it's in fucking Toronto.
Yeah.
But
I feel like whatever we do when we post this, we have to like SEO and tag it so that the next time somebody goes to Google and is like, where does Quince take place? They can be directed to this here podcast.
And still not get an answer.
Well, Nicole did some sleuthing.
I did. I did some pondering.
Okay, I have a nitpick too. And it really is about the treatment of car seats throughout the entire movie. Like, I felt like I was always paying attention to what they were doing with the car seats. Like, at one point they get back from the hospital and it's mom and dad in one car, and then you can fit three car seats in the back, and then it's Jamie and her friends in the taxi. So there's, I was like, where are the other two babies? And then I think you can kind of see Brad holding a car seat just in his lap in the taxi. And I was like, is that, that was the plan you had? And then they all like pile into the bus, the VW bus, and they're just like flinging the car seats in there. Like, I was very worried about the transportation of the children this entire time.
There's also a moment where Jamie is like holding the baby and not supporting its head at all, and this is supposed to be like a day old or 2 day old baby that she's just like whipping around a little bit, and I'm just like, ah, the head, please somebody tell her.
My nitpick is not really a nitpick, it was just a personal attack, which I think also made me not like the movie. The art teacher therapist at some point stared at Jamie and was like, where is your heart, Jamie? How is she supposed to know? I don't really know that. And I thought that was a very rude moral of the movie, that she was supposed to find what she wants to do with the rest of her life as a teenager and have that decision made, because Mr. Art Teacher, that's hard. That's all.
I also felt that, like, the moment he said that, I was like, oh, am I supposed to know that? Like, is that a thing I'm supposed to be like, my heart is here? And
Yeah, my heart drawing babies.
If anybody listening could tell me when I, at what age exactly I should stop thinking this is what I want to be when I grow up, that'd be great, because yes. I still regularly am like, that'd be cool to be when I grow up. And then I'm like, damn it, you're 33.
You done growed up.
You done did it.
Yeah, the art teacher therapist man was very interesting in just that he was, I feel like he was just there to fill any plot hole that was there in the first draft of the script. They were just like, well, who could say something to fix that? Aha, the art teacher. Because he even as a teacher, like, he comes across as like caring and supportive, but he says when he's talking to them at one point, he's like, I'm a teacher, I don't have to be fair. And it's like, dude, that's your like main job, is that you like, if you're not judging these kids fairly, you're a very bad teacher.
Yeah, he was like very flippant as a teacher. That would not fly as an actual, maybe that played into his zany art teacher role, but if any of my teachers had said that to me, like, I don't have to care, I'd be, and they were kind of like playfully sassy with him.
I think he just came across too real and not zany enough. Like, a lot of like DCOMs have that sort of zany adult friend that we get in these, and this was not one of them. Like, he was like, the zaniest thing about him was that he drove a VW bus. Like, ooh.
Because Jamie discovers herself through her love of art, and that's what she wants to do with the rest of her life, as she decided as a preteen, as a middle schooler or whatever, we are talking about our own history with art.
I just had that realization of like, is she gonna like continue to draw her siblings forever? Because that was like the one thing she drew in this that like got her the spot in the art show, and it was like, okay, you guys are my five muses forever.
No pressure or anything, but
yeah. Stay cute, please. But yeah, I'll jump in and go first with the art history lesson on myself. I was one of those people who in like second or third grade, somebody told me I could draw well. And I was like, well, I'm going to be an artist now. And that was for a long time, like through most of grade school. was kind of like what I wanted to do. It was like be a Disney animator or just draw cartoons or be involved with cartoons in some way. And so my mom was thankfully very encouraging of that and like sent me to like an art camp thing at I lived in the middle of nowhere, cornfields, Illinois. I went to a place called Betty's Art Barn for my summer art camps. So shout out to Betty. And I also was like, yeah, in every art class, I did win a blue ribbon once with some art that I submitted as part of a 4-H fair. So that's a sentence. And yeah, it was one of those things that I don't know necessarily when that stopped. I feel like it was something that I could always do as a kid. Like I still have, my mom has at her house, tons of pieces of art that art is a high term for most of these. They're drawings of like Tasmanian Devil and Foghorn Leghorn a lot of times. but like drawings I did of these things that like for a kid were pretty impressive. And even looking back, I'm like, oh yeah, good job, young me. That looks like a Tasmanian Devil. Good job. And like my family was not a science-y family. So like I was never pushed into like that side of schooling as much to my detriment. Like I was a bad student, but I did really well in all my art classes and really enjoyed them. And it's something that I still try to keep doing from time to time. But yeah, I feel like that's one of those things that I don't really know about any of you is like your artistic talent / past.
I don't know if this will surprise anybody, but I have no artistic talent. I'm one of those people that is like, I could draw you a stick figure, man. Like, I mean, my dad is an artist. He paints. So he, growing up, we were always around him painting, and not only him painting, but talking about like, you know, retiring one day. And when he did, he would, you know, just, he wants to dedicate more time to painting. We have portraits of his like all over our house, my mom and dad's house now. And not only like painting, but he would always come up with like weird, like arty side shoot things, like engraving glass, and I don't know, he would just pick up all kinds of things. So growing up, a trip to the art store was like a blast for us. And he'd be like, he would go to get his supplies, but take us girls with him, and we would get to pick one thing out. So even though I wasn't particularly good at art, we were always like painting and drawing alongside with him. I feel like anything that I have that's practical in my personality, I get from my mom, and anything creative at all, I get from my dad. So that was very true growing up. I don't think though that I like appreciated like more traditional art until I took one of those college 101 art classes that you have to take. And I just had the most phenomenal teacher. I can't even remember her name anymore. And maybe this won't surprise you either, but it was learning how to critique art and like break down art that I was like, ooh, art is cool. And I remember writing like really involved like essays for that class, and, you know, kind of critiquing art or comparing art pieces and things of that nature. So this is the first time that I felt like really drawn into that. But growing up, you know, arts and crafts were big.
For me, also growing up, arts and crafts were really big. Not because I don't think, sorry, I had to like consider whether my parents were arts and crafty. I don't think they are. I think my dad is very, will tackle any project that comes his way. And so like now he's very into baking. So he'll bake lots of cakes from the Great British Bake Off or things like that and like try and perfect that. So if I ever had a problem crafting something, whether it was something really small, like I remember we would do contests where we would both draw Pokemon and his were always better than mine because he could like copy it better than me or remember it better than me when I was really little. Or when I built theater sets in high school, he was like, oh, I have advice for like how you should construct this PVC pipe to make it not fall down. And I guess all that to say, art was super big part of my childhood. Like Matt, I also wanted to be some sort of artist growing up, and I would like draw all the time and watch a lot of cartoons, do a lot of arts and crafts projects, learn how to make friendship bracelets or knit or latchhook or like any sort of craft kit. I would always put those on my birthday list or Christmas list. And so my grandparents would like get me one of those Klutz, make a friendship bracelet books. And then I would do all of them. And then I'd be out of materials. And I'd be like, well, can't do that anymore. Which is about the right length for my attention span too. I'd be like, okay, I learned how to do a thing. I'm done. I'm free from that thing. And now I'll move on to something else. But I actually sort of continued it growing up. So in the high school that I went to, or junior high slash high school that I went to, you could take art. So I took art for 5 years there. And it was just like a studio art class. So I learned how to like draw in colored pencil and paint and sculpt and do printing, like a whole variety of things. And then in college, I also did theater, technical theater, not acting type stuff, but I did set design and set painting. And then I took a lot of figure drawing classes. That was probably like my peak artistic skill, was when I was taking regular figure drawing classes and actually knew anatomy. And then I've always sort of been into cartoons, like I said. So I have this pipe dream of starting a webcomic or doing comics work in the visual sense someday, because I already do comics work in the editorial sense, but I am too bashful about my art and out of practice. But I would really like to get back into it. And it's been a huge part of my life.
I feel like my answer is a mishmash of all of these answers. I also feel like it was a really big presence in my childhood. Like Mari, though, I have no actual talent. So there's that piece of it. But like, it was very present in my childhood. My mom sold art when I was growing up, and eventually like opened an art gallery in the mall. And that is the first job that I had, was working at the art gallery. But I didn't really care that much about the art. I just liked framing paintings because I got to use power tools. but as a kid, I also had like every art kit imaginable. And it was like, the thing with the beads, they're like little plastic beads, and like you would melt them under an iron. Mm-hmm. I was obsessed with that. And there was like sand art, and there's like anything like overpriced, overmarketed art toy can we sell to this 7-year-old. The first job that I ever wanted was to be a fashion designer when I grew up, which mostly means that all throughout elementary school, I drew women with like feathery or like big drapey sleeves. I have lots of drawings in my parents' house of women with big drapey sleeves. My childhood self would, I'm sure, be very disappointed by the lack of drapey sleeves in my life. But, you know, I don't know. That is what I assumed a fashion designer did. Just drew lots of pictures of women's clothing. And yeah, I also had a family member who I would make trips to the art store with. For me, it was my grandma, who paints a ton. She has this whole like series in her apartment of watercolors of all of us grandkids as kids. It's very fun when like little kid members of the family, now that, you know, like my cousins all have babies, so like the babies are coming to grandma and grandpa's place and seeing the paintings and like trying to guess who is who with varying success. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they think it's them. None of them are you. I'm sorry. but my grandma also used to take us to the art store with her when we would go visit. And we would go to like art museums and stuff, because my grandparents live in Chicago. So like, I don't know, museums were an essential part of going to visit my grandparents. But yeah, I don't know. Long, rambly answer to say that I feel like art has always had a very strong presence in my life without me ever being personally super into it or having any personal skill whatsoever.
I also drew a bunch, like one of my artsy, I don't know, kind of stages that I went through when I was growing up was fashion drawing. And like, I had one summer in particular, I couldn't tell you the age, where I had like a binder and I just set up all of these like, you know, bland human forms so that I could spend the entire summer just drawing outfits on them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and mostly they turned into ball gowns because those were the most fun to draw. But yes, I also had that. And I did not remember it until you talked about the drapey sleeves. And then I was like, oh, man, there's some ball gowns out there with my name on it.
I thought it was so important as a kid to sign all of my art. So like every drawing I have from as a kid, painting, whatever, all has my little signature down in the corner.
Yep, me too. And you can see the evolution of my signature as I tried to be fancy. Like I did a really big C and then put the E-R-I inside the C.
Ooh.
Wow, artsy. Or just like a big C-R and then small other. I really went dramatic with my variations on signatures.
Is that your still your signature?
My signature is more of a scribble now. It does not look like the variations of my very fancy painted ones. I guess it is kind of like my signature is like a big C and then Riley. Don't forge it.
That's, yeah. I want to meet the forger who can listen to someone describe their signature and go, got it.
Yeah. Cyber crimes, Matt.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, you very politely said, don't do it. So they're not going to. Yeah. Don't worry.
So they know. Yeah. It's rude if you disobey my wishes.
Yeah.
And now it is time to share the lessons that we learned from this movie, this nothing movie that we watched. But Matt, you kind of liked it. What did you learn from Quince?
I learned that before you decide you want to have kids, check to see if there's a history of multiples in your family and consider if you might have Quince at some point, because you want to know if that's a possibility.
I learned that you should get regular oil changes for your old VW bus because you never know when some local kids might need it in an emergency.
I learned that when in doubt, when naming your kids, just go with the alphabet. That's what you remember.
And I learned that it's completely acceptable to tell middle schoolers to figure out who they want to be for the rest of their lives. And now to close out this episode of Cooler Than Homework, it is time for Sari, knower of nothing, to guess the plot of the next movie. Next time on Cooler Than Homework, we are watching The Other Me.
It's been a minute. I don't remember anything about the movies before this one. I guess I can look at our spreadsheet. Okay, we've had two realistic ones. Nope, the talking horse was last. Oh, man. Okay, I'm gonna go alternating. The Other Me sounds like it could be realistic, probably supernatural. There's a boy named Tommy, sweet Tommy, who is feeling really down and out about his life. Like maybe he's not super popular, not super athletic, not super smart. So we see a montage of him kind of down and out on his luck. Doesn't really have any friends. And then he makes a wish to like be a more popular version of himself. He puts on, or he finds sunglasses on the street that are magic sunglasses. And then he puts them on and makes like weird expressions towards a mirror, like a full-length body mirror. This is a moment of levity in the movie. But then he trips and he falls in and the sunglassed mirror man comes out and that's the other him. And so it's like Coraline, but less creepy. And he is stuck on the other side of mirrors watching the other me go through school and become really popular. And all of a sudden he's like smart and strong and gets the girl that he's been pining after named Annie, Tommy and Annie, and like asks her to the middle school dance, but really it's the evil mirror clone. And so for part of the movie, Tommy's like, ah, rats, people really like the fake me more than the real me. But then Mirror Tommy turns out to be a real dick and starts like being too cool for school and like one of the bullies. And then I guess I should get the tagline. I'm really off track, probably. What's the tagline?
Unfortunately, I can't find one, so I can't help you.
Oh, that's okay. I'll round out the story then. I'm already all in. And then Tommy realizes that the way to escape the mirror is to accept himself. So while evil Tommy, the other me, is like showing, like putting gel in his hair, spiking it forward. I don't know what year we're in, early 2000s, maybe, bleaching the tips. Then Tommy is like, hey, I want my life back. And then they fight. And then he's like, no, I like being me. But previously the movie had said, I hate being me or something like that. And then he steps back into his life and everyone is still a little bit like startled around him because they think he's a bully, but he makes up with people and people realize that, wow, Tommy's all right after all. And the end.
Great. Well, join us next time on Cooler Than Homework and find out if that's the plot. If you are enjoying this podcast, tell your friends, write and review it, all that good stuff. We would love to hear all of your thoughts on Quince. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up at snarksquad.com/decom, or you can find us on Twitter at decomsquad. I am at Sweeney Says.
I am at Matthew Gatos.
You can find me at My Name is Marines.
And I'm at C.E. Riley.
This podcast is a Snark Squad production, edited by me, transcribed by Mari, and our theme music is by Stefan Chin. This week, today we are talking about, I was like, I don't want to talk about weeks. I don't want to talk about time. I want to situate this in time in any
this
way
season,
whatsoever.
We are.
In 2020, we're talking about.
Welcome to our quarterly podcast.
We're doing our best.